And recording. Thanks all for coming. This is the February 12th B call. This was the week that it's every other week that there is an A call. And this morning on the A call, we talked about the Aries Framework Go architecture and saw a demo. So that was pretty cool. Please remember the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the antitrust policy. Let's be nice to each other and avoid doing stuff that would inhibit the application of our work. Is there anyone new this week that would like to introduce themselves that has not taken the opportunity to do previously?
So I've introduced myself on the morning call, but not this. I'm Sven Hammann. I'm from ETH Zurich. I'm a PhD student interested in protocols, especially in the SSI space and formal verification of these protocols. I've seen that my name has been actually on the meeting page for a while because of something I presented at the last Rebooting Web of Trust. And so I plan to sometimes attend this meeting. So also if at some point you'd be interested in a small presentation about what I'm doing about this, wouldn't go into too much detail, but then that we could finally maybe have this conversation, then maybe let me know beforehand, write me an email, then I could prepare something and present it here.
Sven, that sounds great. We'll talk offline about that. I'd love to have you present. Anyone else would like to introduce themselves? Awesome, awesome. Thank you and welcome everybody, new and old. The Hyperledger Diversity, Civility, and Inclusivity group has a survey that they'd like us to take, and that link is here that will help us get better at all of those things. I already mentioned the morning call and that we talked about the Aries Framework Go and saw a demo. That was pretty cool. And I believe that recording is posted. And then the other thing, relevant piece of information is the DIDCOM working group. And we've begun talking about routing and some of the details there. And so if you are not involved there and you would like to be, that's something to do sooner rather than later. Any other related meetings that that we wish to call or could call attention to? Noticing this is technically not true. We have had a meeting since then. Okay, let's move on to releases and work updates. This has been copied from this morning's meeting, so if you have updated information there, then it's been copied over here, and you don't need to re-enter that. Is there anyone? Let's do the big ones. Shared libraries was a bigger conversation. Do we have Richard here? Would you mind giving a little bit of an overview there?
Yep. I was just remembering to post the meeting from this morning. Thanks for the reminder, Sam. The libraries, the notes are the best summary that I could put together. There's four streams of work at the moment. The team at BCGov has been leading the work on the Indy VDR, breaking libindy, the ledger resolver out of libindy and making it available externally. And the idea is that when we have an Aries interface for resolving ledger resolution, then we can put another layer on top of that to match whatever we come up with in the future. And then Mike has been leading the work to pull Anon creds out into its, or credential exchange out into its own set of libraries. We're going to need one library for the Aries tier that handles encoding, decoding, all the ledger independent stuff. And we'll need another ledger that's more indie specific, so we keep those separate. And then the next thing on deck is to take out a libindy, the pack unpack is its own library. And then we need to start working on the Aries wallet. And Mike and Cam have started one of those. And they're starting from scratch, trying some new ideas, seeing how that goes. And then we do also want to evolve the indie wallet to be an Aries KMS. And that work hasn't started yet, but if anybody wants to help with that, we'd love to collaborate with whoever's interested. Oh, and one update from this morning's call. People pointed out that there's other open source projects named Taiga, but the, so I was thinking, so we're going to have to pick another name, but we're playing with names. Just we want to make sure each KMS has its own name so we can refer to them and not overlap.
Naming things is so easy to do, Richard. So I appreciate your efforts there.
So easy to do. I name the same thing over and over and over.
Thanks. Excellent. We skipped the Aries protocol test suite. Daniel?
Sorry, just finding the mute. Let's see. Not a ton has changed since last week, but just reiterating that the issue credential as well as present proof tests are now in the test suite and are ready to be tested against.
Awesome. Thank you, those working on that. Aries Cloud is in Python.
I'll have to update the notes. We did release 0.4.2. So that release is out there. I think that was done between last week and this week. So that's done. It just added largely a patch from the previous. It included something that got dropped inadvertently in 0.4.1. So that wasn't so fun, but that's all there. And that's the main work that's been done. I'll leave it at that.
Okay, thank you. And then Troy, anything in addition to the mentioning of the demonstration and the stuff we had in the call this morning?
No, I think that's all. You can watch the video hopefully when it's posted if you want.
Yep. And Richard's doing that now-ish. Perfect. SDK Ruby, Jack. I thought I saw Jack. I don't see Jack.
In his update from this morning, he did mention the Aries Rails Docker that should make it a lot easier for people to play with and easy to spin up something on their Heroku free tier. So that should be good for anybody interested in playing with it.
Yes, he didn't mention that. Thank you for bringing that up. That's in the notes. Anything else that we want to add? I'll mention that the Aries Toolbox, we are working on a Getting Started video and that will likely target the sort of using some of the included demonstrations and the plugin that we have for the Akapai code base. So we're working on that. Also, one of the highly requested features for demos and training was the ability to instruct an agent to talk to send a basic message to another agent, and so we've added that, and so that's actually pretty cool. But and it'll likely end up in the demo as well, the getting started video. Any other updates? JavaScript or we're getting an update on the rich schemas work on screen here from Ken, I think.
Yep, we had. Brent and I were able to finish the encoding hype for Indy and the RFC for Aries, and those are now available for review. I'll drop links in as soon as I can figure out what those links are.
Awesome. Thank you, Ken. And the URSA 0.3.2 was released, which included the key exchange methods, which were needed, and so libsodium can now be replaced with those. Also, there was a question about the speed of that. Libsodium has well known speed, and Mike said it was profiled, and libsodium is a tiny bit faster. But in a very small scale, and they'll be roughly equivalent for nearly all uses of the library. That should be easy to do if you're trying to not use libsodium. Other updates that we may have skipped or passed over or new stuff? Awesome. On our agenda today, we have two main topics. Daniel Hardman with talking about names, states, and protocols, and chain credentials with Paul and Jan. But before that, we wanted to play the PR and the issue game today to try and catch up and make some progress on the things that we need. The first thing I wanted to review is PRs. This last time, we didn't We didn't resolve anything, giving our pending discussion of what needed to happen with DidExchange. This is a proposal to move DidExchange from proposed to demonstrated. Some conversation about that. And then last week we talked about the various things that needed to be done. A bunch of that was going to be wrapped up into an invitation protocol. Work on that has begun. The BCGov team is working on that, and I've been collaborating to see if we can get that moving forward. So I wanted to revisit this one quickly and see if we wanted to take an action on this particular PR to change the status of this RFC, or if we wanted to push it off into a future time.
Yeah. Hey, hi, this is George. So I sort of missed that conversation last week. I'm fine with closing the PR right now because I too think it's incomplete. However, where can I follow up the work that you just mentioned with your collaboration with you and the BCGov?
That hasn't gotten going yet. Steven is going to arrange a call so we can talk over a proposal that Andrew wrote up just between he and Steven, and Steven shared with me. So I think that we're trying to put something together that then we could sort of propose generally and discuss the community. If you'd like to be involved in those conversations, we'd welcome that. And Steven Kern is the one to coordinate with.
Okay, I'll follow up with Steven.
But yes, cool. We love that. And what we hope to do is put together sort of the preliminary ideas from folks who have been talking about it, and then we can bring it up to the community and see what we missed and try to figure out how to move forward from there. So perfect. Okay, so the conclusion is to close this one. And you're okay with that, George?
Yep.
With the expectation that we will reopen it in the future when the status is closer to needing to be changed?
Yes, of course.
Perfect. Okay, we will do that. The other thing that I wanted to mention on this, most of the stuff is relatively, I don't want to get and talk about the stuff that's only been open for a couple of days just because we haven't had our normal conversation cycles yet. The next one up was Bruce Conrad opened up. This is a relatively small one here, and he is adding the Pico Labs implementation under the protocols, the implementation section of the protocols RFC, as well as the 348, which is the transition message type to HTTPS as well. Does anyone have any issues merging this one as well? Okay, we will also accept that one. And just then the third.
Sorry, Sam. Quick question. Why yep. all that PR is doing is adding an implementation.
Right.
So why? Just kind of curious.
Why are we reviewing it?
Yeah, yeah.
Mostly just because it's been 12 days, and I will take credit for not being as on top of things as we need to be. So I just wanted to just give it 10 seconds of airtime and make sure that there's no problem with that. So this should just be approved. Is the answer.
So I would agree, but I'd also like to commend Bruce for doing this and making sure that everyone else is hopefully on top of this. This is trying to move us so that we can use the HTTP message request type. So hope others are paying attention to it. So that this is actually useful that we didn't do it to remind everyone that we want everybody to do this.
Not just to make the change, not just to do the PR, but to make the code change, yes.
Exactly. And then add yours to the list that says, hey, we completed step one.
Perfect. Okay, the last one I want to talk about here was 289. This is a PR which includes a mention of TLS. This is the Trust Over IP stack one, and this is the change here. The diff doesn't show the details, but most of the verbiage is the same. There's just a minor bit that has changed there. Do we have Drummond today? We do have a Drummond. Drummond, I know you've been working on 289.
I think that's probably some other Drummond you're looking for.
Nice. Any thoughts or feedback on this particular PR?
I haven't looked at it yet. I've been sort of buried in stuff. So I need to look it over, and I'd be happy to now that it's like front and center. I just got down to our Salt Lake City office. So, oh yeah, perfect. That's exactly what needs to be done.
I can't add you. What's your handle?
It's Talltree. Yeah. Boy, that was a long time ago. I got that. It's so funny.
So right. It's not going to let me. I don't know why I can't add you as a reviewer. Can I assign you?
Yeah, assign me.
You are weird. Unassignable. I don't know why that's happening.
He has to be in the Hyperledger org.
Oh.
What?
I'm going to do it this way.
How is it that I'm submitting?
You can be involved without being in the a member of the Hyperledger org. You can still be involved.
What do I need to do that?
I don't know.
I think you just rocket chat.
You just have to take me. You have to take me to dinner, Drummond. That's.
Wait a minute. We can get dinner out of this? Man.
Wow. What a deal. All right. Whoever can help me with that, love to do that. Meanwhile, I'll go look it up now. What? Okay, that one right there. All right. I'll go and take a look. Okay.
There's one by Daniel Hardman here that we're not going to talk about because he's going to talk about that today. So cart, horse, and all that. The other thing that I wanted to skip over. Thank you, by the way, for feedback on the PRs. I wanted to look at the issues quickly. There's this one in particular about a routing contradiction. And there's some Kyle and some Tomislav and some Lavesh comments on here. Any feedback or thoughts on the right way to process this one moving forward? We kind of have some ongoing conversations about routing over in the DIDCOM working group, but as it relates to this group, that I wanted to see what the right action was on this particular issue.
Well, what's the proposal? It sounds like from the quick read I just did of the ticket that Sergey's just saying there's a contradiction, but he's not proposing how to resolve it. Is that accurate?
I believe that is accurate, yes. In practice, all we're doing is putting keys. We're not actually allowing DID key references. Allowing is a strong word, but in practice, we're using keys, not anything else at this point. Lavesh, proposed that we allow a key in the two of the forward message. I believe that's the way it's actually being currently implemented in forwarding, is that the two is a key, not anything else. Now, longer conversations about whether that should be the case and things are appropriate as we sort of move forward. But from a practical sense as it exists now, we may want to handle it that way.
Well, if nobody's advocating any actions, then I'd say just close the ticket. But if we really should be advocating an action, like we need to go make these two RFCs harmonize with each other, then let's identify what that action is right now. You said, Sam, that you think a key is what's being used right now. Should we
yes.
The RFCs as they exist right now to say that right now a key is the way we're doing it. And then we can have a separate ticket about whether we should change that, but at least make all of them reflect current understanding.
The way we're currently doing it, and I'm looking to the BCGov team and Street Cred, we had a recent conversation about this to try and align the specifics around this. But I believe the two that we're actually sending, the conversation, by the way, was the encoding of this particular string, but it also relates to the two. I believe we're using a key here. Is that correct? I'm going to make everyone think about code trivia. Framework Go, I believe, has also implemented this.
Yeah, we're using keys for now. We're also following up on Daniel, like just waiting to see what happens on Daniel's in progress RFC, though. What about forwarding?
So, Troy, I withdrew that RFC, but many of the same ideas I've now exposed in a pull request against the DIDCOM spec over in the DIDCOM working group, including all of the stuff about the updated version of the forward message. So if you're interested in that topic, that's the place to follow it.
Okay.
Andrew, are you able to comment on that?
Sorry, I missed some of the context.
Yeah. Why don't we just take that as an action item? We'll look at what's in ACAPI and follow up, because obviously, and that should cover street cred as well, since we know that's working.
Right.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you're right. It is just keys, but let's just take a look.
So I've added this, and I'm going to assign myself to submit a PR that actually aligns that. That's not a huge change. And I can include a note that like, this is current practice and et cetera. And that way we can well document what's going on now. And then we can further discuss what should be happening as a separate issue.
That's great.
Okay.
Thank you.
So that issues, this is a Tomislav question. That relates to the credential proposal and some things about threading, et cetera. Comments from Stephen Klemp, Kyle, Tomislav, Daniel, and last commented on November 7th by Stephen Klemp. Does anyone have any new information about this topic that isn't in the issue? He's got a few different things that he's talking about.
Sam, one interesting thing in there is where they're calling it schema_ID. We had a conversation with the Novartis project team today, and we're thinking that we'd like to change it to cred_schema_ID, because we're actually pulling out different schema IDs from different places. So to kind of differentiate between a credential schema and a non-credential schema, if you like. Yeah, when you scrolled down, it was somewhere down the bottom, I think.
Right. I feel like there was some good discussion here, but I don't feel like it was resolved. One of the actions we could take is I could reach out and ping the heavily involved folks and see if we can reignite the conversation to figure out what the result is, and that might be the best action today. Okay, I will do that. This is super relevant. It's important stuff, but we're trying to figure out how to either get it resolved or get the knowledge captured somewhere. And so I will. I'll go ahead and reach out to the folks originally involved on that particular one and help them out with that. And then the third one on the list, the last one I'm going to touch is this issue raised by Daniel Bloom about difference between implementations in the spec. Comments from Troy and Steven and Daniel and so on going forth. Andrew Whitehead got involved as well. So any commentary on this particular issue?
So this one was actually brought up a little bit ago, and I took it as an action item to go and investigate more, and I just haven't done that yet.
Perfect. So this goes to Daniel. All right. If you would take a look at that one, that would be awesome. Cool. Okay. I'm going to call the end of the game there. We've got some resolutions, some path forward, and that's really useful. Next on the agenda is Daniel Hardman with Namespaces and Protocols. You ready for that, Daniel?
Yeah. Let me share the right window here.
I spitballed 30 minutes. We have a little bit of flexibility in today's schedule if we need to, but I wanted to make sure to leave some time for Paul and Jan at the end.
Okay. I the actual content I have to present here will be less than 30 minutes, but it might trigger a bunch of discussion. So we can just cut it off and agree to discuss it more later if we want, if you want to time box it. Do whatever you want as far as raising your hand when you want to stop me.
Yep.
Okay, so this topic is actually a two-part topic. And first I want to talk about states and problems. So this has to do with how we communicate between agent one and agent two in a way that makes their states clear enough. And maybe that's a good enough introduction to this. So let me switch into present mode, I guess. I'll just do it this way. Did Zoom keep my screen capture so that it shows that
yes.
This put one thing? Okay. So this is just a quick review here. We have been saying for a long time that a protocol is a recipe for a stateful interaction. And that's a nice short definition of a protocol. There's more that could be said about it, but it's useful. And what I've come to feel and why I'm bringing this topic to the community call is that as a group, we've thought pretty deeply about the recipe part and about the interaction part, but maybe we haven't been thinking deeply enough about the stateful part. And that's what I want to talk about. So let me frame this in terms of a familiar interaction to all of us. What interactions occur while you're shopping on like Amazon.com or some other similar kind of a big online website? There are interactions that change the state in your cart. There is an interaction that can happen that represents progress towards checkout. Usually checkout is a 2 or 3 step process. There could be a history of recent searches and cart items so that, you know, you put something in the cart, then you say, never mind, I don't want that. But when you go back and you go browsing on the main, you see things that say you might be interested in, and the things that it's prompting you about are tied to history that's accumulated during the time you've been logged in. It might keep track of what your last used credit card and mailing address are, what it knows about your current geolocation, whether you've input a coupon or a gift card, et cetera, et cetera. And the question that I want you to think about with me is, how do these states interact with one another and how much do we care? I'm not claiming here that we care so much about this that we should drop everything and this is, you know, fixate on just states here. But I'm trying to make a case that there are many interactions that billions of people do that have very high economic value that are very stateful, and we take the statefulness for granted a bit. So this is where it starts to get interesting for me is, so what happens when you're trying to check out and a credit card is denied? Over on the right side of the screen here, I'm trying to show that, you know, you have an orderly progression of states from the time you start to the time you finish, and maybe you're near the end and you go back one step. Now, this isn't a guaranteed answer. It's possible that you could change the state in some other way, but this is probably a common answer when you try to check out with a credit card and it's denied, is that you probably just go back to the part of the checkout workflow where you have to choose a different card. Meanwhile, I want to contrast that with what we have said as a community about what happens when we're in the middle of issuing a credential and an error occurs. Today, what we say in the RFC is, well, we go back to the start. We start over. Now, I'm not claiming that that's a bad answer. I'm just trying to point out that it's a different answer and that the answers are not obvious. it's entirely possible in some workflows to decide that the best answer when you encounter an error at step 5 is to go back to step 4. It's also possible to decide, for very good reasons, that if you get to step 4 or 5 and you have an error, you just start over. So the reason that I think this matters to us is that if we were writing centralized systems, the state would be unambiguous because the web server that all other parties talked to would mandate what the state is, and you would get one crisp answer. Either it would be we go back one step, or we go back two steps, or we go back to the beginning, or whatever, and you would just know that was the behavior of the system. But because the parties that we're interacting with are not servers that mandate how we think about state, and rather we're using a decentralized paradigm, it's possible for one actor in a protocol to make one assumption about what happens during an error, and for another actor in the protocol to make a different assumption about the consequences. So one thing that I have thought for a long time is that we need to be better about specifying the consequences of an error in a protocol definition. That is, we're talking about, let's say, the issuance protocol. I'll pick on that one because it's easy. We need to say, if an error happens when you're in this state, then the outcome is you go to state X. And what we might find if we thought about that hard is that not all errors trigger the same outcome. I listed a bunch of errors in the sub-bullets here. The network seems to be really slow. I don't know what type of crypto you want to use. These are all errors that could happen during like a DID resolution or some other kind of interesting interaction with DIDCOM. And they have different kinds of implications. Like the network seems to be really slow right now is probably an error that would trigger some kind of retry logic. But your DID didn't resolve might not be a retryable kind of a condition. What I'm trying to point out is it might need to even be more granular than if an error happens in step 5, go back to step 3. It might need to be if the following 5 error types occur in step 5, go back to step 3. If these other 2 types occur, go back to the beginning. And we might also find that agents, we want to allow agents to make different judgments about whether they want to start over or not. So something that's kind of been implied in the problem report RFC for a long time, but it's never been expanded. Nobody's currently doing this, including me or any software I touch, but I've always thought this might be a good idea, is when we send a problem report, we might want to say, look at the third attribute there, new state. So this would allow one agent to say to another, yeah, I experienced the following error. Here's its code, and here's some human-friendly text about the error. And this is the state that I am transitioning to as a result of this error. That would make it very clear to another party who gets this problem report that, you know, either I've given up entirely and you have to start over with me, or no, I'm now back in the state of, you know, wanting to ask for your credit card or something like that. If we did something like this, then we would need symbolic names for our errors or for all of the states that are in our protocol. Now, many of the protocol RFCs that we have right now have symbolic states because state names, because we have a matrix where we've listed and we've said, in this state, if this message arrives, then you transition to that state. And this state and that state are formal names. But there are some RFCs, and a good example is RFC 36 and RFC 37 about credential issuance and proving, that do not actually give formal names to states. They only give formal names to messages. And the state is just whatever place you can point to in the diagram where you're at. And I think we would need to formalize some of that stuff a bit if we wanted to enable this kind of behavior. There was an interesting ticket that was raised by Stephen Klump a while back where he was asking whether the ACK at the end of the issuance should be on receipt of the message or on acceptance. This is really a question that arises because we're not crisp enough about our description of our expectation with states. And we resolve that particular ticket, but I think there's a larger phenomenon here, and there's an advanced mode for ACKs. You can go look it up in RFC 317 that's currently just proposed, that suggests that when you ask for an ACK, you can say, please send me this ACK when you transition to state X, instead of just, please send me an ACK. That would allow us to be far more precise in knowing when a particular thing happens. Like the previous thing about problem reports, this particular mechanism, if we were to use it, requires that we have very thoughtfully chosen symbolic names for states that we publish as part of the protocol definition. So the first part of my presentation is basically over here. I would like to suggest to the community that if we have protocols that don't give names to states, we should update the protocols. These are not breaking changes because you can implement a protocol, generally speaking, without knowing these states. All we're doing is really adding additional clarification about what we expect formal names to be, and then it would enable fancier problem reports, and it would enable a more sophisticated kind of ACK if we needed to. And I suggest that we modify RFC 3 that describes how protocols work to clarify that all protocol definitions must name their states. They don't have to put in some kind of, you know, fancy state machine diagram or something like that. And if we want to use choreography diagrams like we did in RFC 36 and 37 or whatever, all of that is great. But I'm thinking that we need to actually name the states that can exist so that this other behavior is a little bit clearer and we can talk about it with precision. I have raised a pull request that does these two things. And I wanted to give this presentation on the community call before the pull request was analyzed, so you could have the background of why I raised the pull request and what it's trying to do. So let me just stop there for a minute before I go on to part two and see if anybody has comments so far.
I have one. I've been nervous about this in the past, and I've become not nervous about it. And here's why. Declaring the states in the protocol doesn't require any sort of deep internal state management inside of your agent. It just means that when it unifies the thinking about which states there are and what should happen, such that when you communicate with someone on the other side, you can be more precise about the error you send them, or report state, for example, in that manner. So it feels like in order to utilize this or to do it at all, you have to have a very rich state management system inside your agent. That isn't true. I came to that realization, and I wanted to share it in case anyone else was of the same thinking.
So this is Drummond. It's probably worth pointing out something fascinating I just realized watching Daniel's presentation, which is the whole idea of having named states, or shall we more broadly call them identifiable states, is actually the heart of the whole idea of REST architecture. Representational state transfer, you have a URI for every representation of state. Wow, what a concept.
Yeah, that's very true, Drummond.
I don't mean by that to imply this is at all. I'm saying, you're basically saying the goodness of REST is in is in this. It doesn't mean you have to implement this as, you know, as a REST architecture. It just happens to be consistent with that principle of web architecture.
Yeah. And I also want to kind of pile on to what Sam said here. This is the substance, the essence of what it would be to update an RFC. And all that it's doing here is it's just saying, here are the names for the states that an issuer goes through. And here are the names for the states of the holder. We could merge this pull request, and nobody who has implemented PR36 has to make one line change anywhere in any of their code. This is not requiring that implementers do something differently. It's requiring that we document differently. That's all.
Daniel, so in the past, I've found the state state tables pretty useful. But now you're saying that all we have to do to update existing RFCs and I guess new RFCs going forward would be just to add a few bullet points. I'm just wondering why we don't continue just using the state matrices.
Well, I'm going to, in any RFCs I write, I will use the state matrix because I think it says some useful things, but I feel like there are people who are a little bit put off by it. It feels to them like what we're recommending is you all have to go out and implement a state machine, and this is exactly how you have to do it and whatever. And that was never the intent. The matrix is just a way of forcing us to think through all the possible combinations of states and messages so that we know whether we're handling everything. But what I guess what I'm saying here is I'd be willing to take anything. I'd be willing to take a bulleted list or a state matrix as long as we have a name that I know what it is.
Well, yeah, so I feel you, but so I don't know. I'm just looking at this right now, and all I see there are like 10 bullet points, and I have no idea how you transition from one to the other, you know, but that's, I don't even know. I'm not even sure what the entry points are, you know, so.
In addition to those diagrams or the state matrices, it's not always clear that what's in the state matrix is the definitive name for the state. And so by making it more clear, I believe we add robustness to it. So it is possible to make a matrix or a diagram that has the canonical name for a state in it, if you will. But it's also easy to overlook that, and because you're making a diagram and you're trying to make it human readable, et cetera. And so I do believe that it is valuable to enumerate them explicitly in a way that makes it clear you're declaring the name of a state. It's similar to the way we declare the actual name of each message, right? We want to be clear that this is the name of the message, and we don't leave things like, oh, well, is it camel cased or kebab cased or snake cased or something to chance, but rather we want to declare clearly that is what it's named.
Just to be clear, the list of states here is not enough by itself. The reason that this particular RFC only shows a list of states is because it also has a very elaborate choreography diagram that already documents a lot of the knowledge that you just mentioned, George. It's just the combination of the diagram plus formal names is what I'm after. And if the diagram you use already has the formal names in it, I would be willing to accept that. If the community votes to be more formal, I will definitely not complain. And you'll see in part two why I care about this for a different reason. But anyway, I'm not really invested in this PR. I just made it mainly to show people what I was thinking when I wanted to present the idea. So we can do whatever you guys think is the best way to approach this.
Can I ask one naive question? You say you can just list the state names here, but if these are actually going to be referred to in code, isn't it actually required that you identify that state in the code?
Well, okay. So if we decided that we wanted to allow, maybe by updating the problem report RFC to describe this, if we wanted to say that when you emit a problem report to another agent, one of the things you can do is you can tell the agent, because of this error, I'm transitioning to state X, and state X is now a string constant that you're getting out of an RFC that listed all the possible state names. than anybody who intended to handle the error by saying, oh, I'm going to take note of this, could handle that string constant in their code. If on the other hand, they said, well, I don't really care what state you're transitioning to. If I see an error, I'm just going to start over. That's, if we decided to allow that behavior, then you wouldn't have to do anything to react when you saw that extra piece of information.
I see. Okay.
So I think what I want to do is jump into part two now and let this idea simmer, because my goal here is not to like decide something. It's just to kind of, I want to plant some seeds and then we can have more conversation about it later. So let me go on to part two and see what ideas this generates for you. Okay. So I want to talk about calling protocols from protocols. Now, a really, really simple, obvious example of this is I'm in the middle of issuing a credential and I want to call a payment protocol. But that is by no means the end of this phenomenon. We've talked about breaking invitations and connections up such that the invitation triggers a connection. We've also talked about inviting somebody to engage in some other protocol, like sending them an invitation to receive a credential. These are all problems that deal with the phenomenon of calling one protocol from another protocol. So the way that we've commonly talked about that payment scenario I just described is I've used the word sub-protocol. And in fact, for a while, RFC 3 that describes protocols in general actually said payment is an example of a scenario that might need a sub-protocol. So we were using that terminology and promoting it there. And I think that's reasonably good terminology, but there's some nuances I want to talk about in a second. So with payment specifically, we have a decorator, actually a pair of decorators, payment request and payment receipt in RFC 75, that say, look, when you are engaged in some other protocol, you can attach to your normal messages something that says, hey, at this point, I want to be paid. And then later, somebody else can send back to you something that includes, hey, here's proof that I just paid you, but we've never described what happens in between. Obviously, the thing that happens in between is you have to run some kind of a protocol to make it work. And so here's a little diagram that shows kind of visually how two protocols might be related. The top one, you know, you've got the play button and the stop button. This represents starting and stopping the protocol, and then you've got some intermediate states there. When you get to the point where the super protocol is ready to invoke the sub protocol, then you make some kind of a call that starts the sub protocol off, and you wait until the sub protocol finishes. And when it finishes, the sub protocol raises its hand and says, I'm done, and here's what I produced. At which point, the super protocol can find out what the sub protocol produced and continue on its way. That's a pretty simple, straightforward mental model of what could happen, but I'm going to mess it up here. Before I mess it up, though, let me just point out this phenomenon of dependencies. In this picture here, I have the word return. How does a sub protocol emit information that the super protocol can consume? Right now, I think there are a few of you out there that are trying to solve problems like this, and you may have come up with some answers to this. Evernim has come up with some answers too. None of the answers that I've thought through feel adequately generalized, and so that's what I'm going to try to do right now is generalize a little bit. And also, let me point out this last bullet. What happens when an error happens in a sub-protocol? What is our expectation about exception propagation? Nobody has ever talked about that, to my knowledge, in community circles, at least not that I know of. The dependence between a sub-protocol and a super-protocol introduces a kind of fragility that's problematic. if the super protocol, let's go back to issuance here, says, I want you to kick off you being my own agent, myself. I need to have kicked off sub protocol X and its payment protocol version 1.1. Here's the message I want you to send to start the protocol. That's a very, what I would call a tight dependency. There's too much knowledge that the super protocol ends up having about the sub protocol. And you end up having to version the super protocol if the sub protocol changes. And it means that the super protocol has to know all the roles and states for the sub protocol at its outset and conclusion. It has to know exactly how to build the first message, including all the semantics from it. And it has to know how to consume the protocol's final message so that it can get the return value out. So if you think about this like a function call for just a minute, the super protocol is like a function, and the sub protocol is like a function that gets called inside the bigger one. You could think about the call surface as an interface. And the way that functions typically work in our programming languages, the calling function typically doesn't have to know everything about the called function. It does need to know its function signature, and it does need to know the meaning of its parameters, and it does need to know its return value, but it doesn't need to know a lot of stuff. And so what happens inside, and that allows the implementation of the other function, the called function, to evolve in moderate amounts without breaking the caller functions. Given that protocols are inherently asynchronous, you could imagine modeling the call between super protocol and sub protocol with an async await pattern, or its equivalent in whatever your favorite programming language is. But now I'm going to make this harder. So back to the checkout problem again for just a minute. What if, and this is, I think, very realistic on Amazon.com, I have seen this myself where I've bought an item and then I get half an hour later or something, I get an email from Amazon saying, sorry, the item that you bought turns out that it's out of stock and we're not going to be able to get it in time. So what do you want to do? They're unwinding an interaction that happened. So what I want to ask us to think about is, how does that influence the way that we build our mental model of the relationship between sub protocols and super protocols? Because if after checkout you get a message like this and the payment clearance protocol hasn't finished yet, that is, Amazon got your payment information but it hasn't actually run your credit card, then you're going to do one kind of abort. But if you've already run the credit card, you're going to do a different kind of abort. So now the relationship between the super protocol and the sub protocol has forks in it. And this can get gnarly in terms of how it resets the state of things that have happened, like the state of your shopping cart, whether you're qualified to give a review of a product you bought, stuff like that. So what I want to suggest is that the real relationship, the correct generalized model of a relationship between two protocols, is actually to call them co-protocols. Now, co-protocols could model sub-protocols, but not the other way around. Co-protocols are a more general construct. So what I'm showing here is similar to the diagram I showed before with sub-protocols, except that what you have when you get to a certain state is an invoke followed by a continue, and now two protocols are evolving independently, possibly somewhat unsynchronized. Both of them are asynchronous interactions, and it's how you interact. We don't even know if they're the same two parties in both of these protocols, but at some point the co-protocol gets to a point where it has to emit something to the co-protocol that started it. And so it doesn't emit of a pre-authorization. I'm thinking about payments here. The payment co-protocol is the smaller one, and it emits when it gets to the pre-authorization stage, and the other protocol finds out, okay, we now have pre-authorization that allows us to proceed a particular way. And then it sends signal back to the co-protocol that's doing payment saying, go ahead and proceed with that interaction that you got a pre-authorization for. This is very flexible, but it's more complicated than simply thinking of the protocol as super and sub protocols. I think that sub protocols are to co-protocols what subroutines are to coroutines. Sub protocols tend to be synchronous, serialized, and stackable. They're thought of as having a single call down and back. They have fixed inputs at first and only invocation, and there's a return value, and they're simple, but they're limited. Coroutines tend to be async, parallel, and you can't use a stack to manage them. You can have multiple calls in either directions with save state and closures and things like that, and you can have inputs at any invocation in any direction. You may or may not have a return value. They're complex, but they're very powerful. I would claim that the thing we're working on here, the protocols, are actually an emergent phenomenon, and it's the emergence of multi-party computing in a way that's never been seen before. And I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg about what protocols are really going to turn into. I think mesh computing and the computing power of thousands of people walking around with cell phones in their pockets is going to be harnessed in radical new ways. But it won't be if the only way that we think about protocols is kind of a very strict, kind of centralized, kind of serialized kind of a model about how they interact. This is just a joke, but the same dependency phenomenon that exists with sub protocols and super protocols could also exist with co-protocols. But in this case, there's a dependency going both directions. And so that's my joke about being codependent.
You gotta be, you're going all the way over there.
So what I want to suggest is that protocols need to think about exposing a co-protocol interface. And you could characterize this interface by answering a series of questions. One of them is the named states question, because I think in a co-protocol world, named states become highly important. So this is actually my deeper motivation for bringing up the named state thing, but it's a far out motivation. This is science fiction that won't happen for a year still, but I gave you in part one my immediate reasons why I cared about it, but this is where I'm really headed. And let me just give you an example of what this interface might look like. So the problem statement for the interface would be, this is the make a payment co-protocol interface. And that's nice because what it does is it allows a super protocol like issuance to get to a certain point and then say, okay, when I get to this point, I need to call a protocol that solves the make a payment problem for me. Okay. And you could ask your agent, well, what protocols do you have that solve the make a payment program? And your agent could say problem. And your agent could say, well, I have a Venmo make a payment protocol. And I also have a Bitcoin make a payment protocol. And I also have a run your traditional credit card make a payment protocol. Which one do you want? And then you could engage with the other party and say, hey, we need to run a make a payment protocol here. Which one do you like? You could find a protocol you like, and then you could run that. But the dependence between the super protocol or the co-protocol now that's doing issuance and the protocol that does the payment stuff can be much less demanding. As long as you know that the co-protocol you're launching will solve the problem that you have, most of the rest of the details become uninteresting. So you have, besides defining the problem, you give some name states for what your co-protocol supports. And you say, here are the inputs that I take. And in this case, the likely inputs to a payment co-protocol interface would be everything in the payment requested decorator. So in order to kick me off, you must specify notify everything that goes in a payment request to Decorator. And then yield is, here is where I tell you what I can give you back. I can give you back a pre-auth received message, where actually when a pre-auth received state is reached, I can yield to you a signed pre-authorization payload. And later, I can give you everything in the payment receipt decorator when I hit the done state. And if you ever ask me to cancel, I will send you an ACK as soon as I hit the cancel state. That would be a statement of the yield of your co-protocol. And then, of course, you can say, are there any other states
Quick time check. We need to switch in a couple of minutes. Have a couple minutes to finish up.
I'll just say this. I wanted to plant the seeds. I've done that. I propose that we start talking about this topic and that we work on an RFC about co-protocols and that we think about which protocols need to be upgraded to be thought of this way. And that's it. So thank you for your time. Sorry I went on so long.
No, that was perfect, and you're not over time. Daniel, I appreciate your thinking on this. I was thinking excitedly about how to coordinate payment with a co-protocol with the mediator coordination stuff that I've been thinking about, right? Because not all mediator coordination requires payment, but when it does, it would be nice if there's a normal way to do that that could prompt a sensible user experience, etc. So very good thinking, and I appreciate that. Next on the agenda, we have Paul and Yen.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hello. We can hear you and see your screen.
I'll get started then. Basically, I've had an offline discussion with Stephen. Hope he's in the call, as it part has to do with his RFC. And I'm also working on the RFC 167 with the consent lifecycle. And I wanted to present some material to think through how we should handle what I call application rules. So what is above what we're developing in errors. And I'm making a problem statement. And Paul, you can jump in at any point if you see something you would like to complement what I'm bringing up. And Stephen, this is also for you if you want any clarification as we go through. So problem statement is that for different industries, it's pharmaceutical, automotive, healthcare, and different technologies, if we're talking about what I often discuss, consent lifecycle, and how do we deal with privacy purpose and rules, that using the verifiable credential to include what I call these special conditions appropriate to the industry or technology and definition of roles or purpose specifically for that area, it might be a lot to put require on a verifiable credential. And typically you'd need what I consider the doing the proof request with your assertions. So this is the problem statement that I wanted to bring up to the forum and see how we could maybe solve it. And by the way, just sound check. You guys are still awake and going?
Yes, we are.
I was starting to nod off, but you just woke me back up.
Thank you. It is almost 11 here. It's 10 in Sweden. But so the guidance that I saw, what is appropriate to be in the verifiable credential or not, I use these two conditions. And I'll clarify by looking at the two RFCs, the 104 and 167. That I'm working at and how I saw it apply. So the one guidance is, do you require assertions through proof request? My principle, if they are not needed, it's not necessary to add them. And I also define this, if you require an application level for, as I described in the problem statement, in an industry or technology that then you also would not add it to the verifiable credential. And this is something we can debate over, and it's just some of how I've seen how we put things in the verifiable credential and what do we put outside. And I have talked to Paul, and we have some ideas of how to put things outside of the verifiable credential. I'm sure you've heard of the hash links that has been touched on before. And I was going to show an example actually using them. So this is taken from the RFC 104 chained credential. Stephen, are you in the call? By the way, I think I saw you on the list, but I just wanted to check.
Yes, I'm on the call. Just so it's clear, 104, which is the chain credential, this is an Evernim Daniel Hardman RFC, as I said in the chat. I'm just a fan of it. I didn't write it, or I just think it's a very important one, and I'm encouraging use. But Daniel Hardman's here and can also discuss it better.
Thanks for that clarification. Then information for you, Daniel. Me and Stephen have been debating or going through some of the what was written in the chain credential, because I saw the delegation and those also the guardianship as important aspects that should be part of the verifiable credential. And what I highlight are attributes. This is examples of the verifiable credential where I thought it would be more of an application level. When we put the provenance proofs where you're trying to say that this issuer has the right to use this verifiable credential from a previous verifiable credential as they're chained, that there is a means of verifying it, performing a proof. Then there are some attributes that you had defined that felt like it's more of how you apply it. How do you understand this granting of the permissions in this example of the delegation? And this specific case, it was a rental of a car. And how somebody goes to valet parking and I'm going to hand it over now. I rented the car and now I'm going to hand it over to the attendee to take care of the car while I eat. And so you're building these provenance proofs. And there are conditions of how these permissions are being applied. And I saw very similarities with the RFC 167, where the consent lifecycle of how do I apply the privacy policy? And I'm going to touch on some examples in the next couple of slides. But I'm just highlighting areas that I would consider possibly to be outside of the verifiable credential. Any questions so far? I'm not presenting the full RFC 104. I'm sure you guys have seen it, but this is to just make it as a comparison. I'll go to the next RFC 167, the one I'm working with, the consent lifecycle. And with the help of Paul, we added what this would be a typical verifiable credential, where there are some attributes that we need to perform some form of proof against. And there's an example that I often take is this validity time to live. How long is this privacy policy or applicable? How often do I need to do a proof request? And in this example, it's 1 month. So I don't need to do a proof request more frequently than once a month. And then there are the blinding identity, which ones may have privacy connotation behind them. And what's highlighted, this hashed payload and payload structured idea is what I've called it outside of the verifiable credential. It's simply a reference to an external schema structure through the payload structure ID and the content of that schema structure. How am I filling it? And the next slide, this slide shows what the data processing. This is a full list. It's an RFC where it lists all the attributes that should be considered when working with GDPR questions. And I highlight, for example, like the car rental example, the purpose of you having access to the data, possibly a policy, a privacy policy URL. Is the usage of this data a single time usage? Am I applying some form of anonymization? For me, that's a layer above. It's an application of how do I apply these consent receipts. And this would be part of what then is described as this hash payload. I'm referring to this structure for attributes that do not need any proof request. And it was important for me to see if the group agrees with this principle of separating what is in the verifiable credential and what should be outside. Because I'm going to propose, I don't know if it's extremely radical, but that we work with the semantics working group in defining these rules that do not necessarily need to be inside of the verifiable credentials, but they're associated with the relationship. So that if any industry or technology group wants to apply these verifiable credentials, but do not need the proofs, they can build using these hash links. And I don't have many more, just one more slide just showing how this hash link is being constructed. I think Paul may have touched on it in the previous call, it's just as a reference. But I'd like to see what people's feedback in developing a separate from verifiable credentials, the rules that may be applied at the application level. Questions, comments? Truman, are you still there?
Does everyone know what a hash link is? Do you want me to kind of explain it a little bit, or are we good?
I thought you've told them before. Maybe
yeah, I think a lot of them know. But basically, a hash link it kind of hashes two parts. It hashes the content of what you're pointing to, but it also hashes the location of where that object is. So it's not ideal for a lot of the use cases that we're working on. We're really only interested in the content, not the location. So for instance, if you were to move something from G Drive to Dropbox, all we care about is that the content hasn't changed. Because the location has changed, we don't want to build an entirely new hash link. So there are some issues that we're working with, but that's basically what a hash link does.
And one thing, reason it's important to agree in how we apply these rules at an application level is that I'm very interested to see that we add option of delegation and part possibly the guardianship when it comes to these consent receipts. We're working with other forums, the Kantara, defining how these consent receipts that they're being approved by ISO in relation to the work that's being done in Hyperledger. And I'd like to get a consensus in the group to develop these rules using this approach.
Yeah, so the Kantara consent receipt is already a global standard version right. 1. And there's a group outside of this, a breakaway group outside of Hyperledger that's working on an advanced consent receipt. And that's being spearheaded by Mark Lazar, who was the main guy that brought the consent receipt to Kantara in the first place. And it's kind of like a consent receipt on steroids. It really is it's an amazing piece of work. And so anything kind of consent related, I'd be inclined to steer through that group rather than within the Hyperledger community, or at least dovetail with those guys, because they really are doing some fantastic work.
Does silence mean consensus in this group?
It means they all left.
Jan, it means consent, of course. Silence means consent.
Oh, great. We need a document that everybody agrees. We rewrite 104 to use this approach. And so we're working in the same direction between our RFCs.
So I don't understand that last comment. Is there something about 104 that you think ought to change because of what you're doing?
I'd like to see if we could find a common approach for what I call the application level implementation of the purpose and rules and roles that might be used. And so I'm separating what's in the verifiable credential, what's held separately. And I'm very interested in the 104 because of the delegation model. And when you're giving consent, you might be giving consent in behalf of somebody else. So it's a guardianship case. And I can see multiple use cases with possibly third party consent. And if we're having one RFC, your case of 104, using attributes that need to be added directly to the verifiable credential, it feels like we might be taking different approaches for the same problem. And I just wanted to see, do we agree it's the same problem or not? Maybe you disagree and you say, no, I think it needs to be.
I don't agree or disagree. I'm stumped. I don't see any commonality at all. So I've missed something. I heard what you were doing with consent and receipts, and I also heard about this hash link feature, and I think all of it is awesome. And I never connected it in any way to RFC 104, so now I'm scratching my head wondering what's common.
That's fine. Let's say in the RFC, there are examples showing the conditions of the purpose of, for example, when you go to a restaurant and I'm going to give it to the valet park guy, he has 2 hours to keep the car. You're giving it conditions of how long do I have access to this car and park in behalf of the one that's Alice who's renting the car. There you've stipulated some rules. Who's going to enforce those rules? Is it going to be done on the ledger? Is it going to be at what layer you enforce those rules? You have them here. You grant, it's based on rent, drive, delegate. What is the role? Valet park. I mean, there's many conditions of what this proxies and permissions.
So there's a concept of controller in one of those RFCs, Daniel, right? Is that what's being referred to here? That the...
So...
Yep.
I mean, first of all, you've got to understand, I think I was the one, I thought there was already a connection, and Jan and Daniel had already connected on this, and I was the one that certainly has connected these two. Here's my thought. When we talked about consent receipts back in like Basel at the Hyperledger Global Forum, we talked about a consent, we talked about a consent receipt being, for example, an organization would issue a credential to a recipient, and the recipient would in turn accept the proof request and respond with a proof that they have given consent. And it was kind of a backwards thing because we didn't have a way for people to issue credentials. I think this gives you a way to do that. So you can, a pharma can say, here is a credential that we know each other. Can you issue delegate that credential to me as a consent receipt that I'm able to do things? And you can define what are those things you're consenting that I can do with them, so that I have some information to show that I am following your wishes. And so that's where I saw these chain credential capabilities as being a way to provide consent. Further, revocation comes into play, because now it's, you know, the person can...
Jan's question was a bit more targeted. He was, his question was more along the lines of who actually enforces the rules and coded, that he's highlighted there in yellow.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, that's not there. That's up to the person who receives the credential. It's never up to the, you know, there's no enforcement of anything on this. If you have much better ways of showing that I told you to do this and you didn't do it. So you have much better, you know, you have verifiable data that you were given direction and you didn't follow it. But you can't enforce anything through this, I don't think, unless I'm missing something.
And that's why I like the hash payload, where you don't need to verify the values. You just need to implement at the application level the enforcement. So it would be above the layer of what we're developing here.
So,
and we let each industry, each technology group who wants to use these verifiable credentials as a framework. And then if they have something specifically for their industry, they can set the enforcement at the layer above.
So the enforcement is done by verifiers. Now,
even for the permissions, understanding who's granting.
The verifiers are the ones that are looking at those permissions. They demand proof that somebody has a permission to do something, because they intend to verify, or excuse me, to enforce some kind of permission model. Now, how verifiers come to get in that interaction and have that motive and whatever is the higher level concern that you're talking about. The intersection with the lower level is just that you give, as Stephen described it, you're able to show in a verifiable way what the permission intention of the other party was. Right. And then, given that you've expressed the intentions, the verifiers are assumed to be operating according to the rules of a trust framework and enforcing those intentions in some way that makes sense in that problem domain.
Yeah, and that's a good point, where we try to apply which industry scope, and the example of what I have in my RFC, the second row of industry scope, it defines which group this would apply to. So in your example, we would put it, the verifier needs to be of this industry, so that they understand when they need to simply validate at a higher level layer, they take it as a whole payload and process it without requiring the assertions of what you are putting into the verifiable credential.
So I think Stephen's comment made a lot of sense to me, and I now understand one aspect of the connection, but I still don't understand the significance of the hash link stuff. I thought that was a very separate topic. It sounds like you feel like there's deep significance to the idea of offloading something out of the credential. And there could be. I'm not challenging that. I'm just saying that part is still mysterious to me.
Oh, probably reducing the size of the credential.
Verifiable. Yeah, you have a limit of 120 or 160 attributes, and I've talked to Paul, and he's talking about 500 attributes. It would be impossible to put them all into the verifiable credential, and so architecturally what makes more sense. Okay, if you don't need assertions, don't put it in the verifiable credential, put it externally. And that's why I picked up on what Paul and also Robert have been promoting, to have these hashed links to.
And that makes total sense to me, and I'm a big fan. My question is, why is that related to the other topic? Size of credentials isn't related to delegation, in my opinion. So I'm you must be seeing a connection I'm not.
It's just, how do you enforce this verifier? How does it enforce these permissions? You mentioned it's up to the verifier. It's up to, and I'm saying, well, yeah, but you need to give a framework for the ones implementing the verifier, that they can implement it. I'm seeing something that's missing in the what we're developing here to be able to offload the verifiable credential. And I saw this link. Okay, maybe I can put it at this through the hash link to a separate scheme and overlay. I think Paul has done a great promotion of this architecture, OCA. That actually we can develop to put down these rules, the roles, how do you do the processing purpose. And I mean, it's a perfect architecture, which doesn't need to be inside the verifiable credential, can be outside as well.
You're still mystifying me. I don't get it. I see this as a problem, and I think it's worthwhile, but I'm not understanding why it's part of the same problem. It seems like we ought to write one RFC that's about, anytime you have a size problem in a credential, here's how to handle it. And then we ought to have another RFC about consent receipts and how it relates to delegation. And you could combine those if you both have a delegation / consent problem and you have a size problem, but I don't see how they really inherently relate to each other.
Yeah, to me, Daniel, it's not necessarily the hashed payload is not necessarily a size problem as well. It could be that it makes more sense to keep it outside of the verifiable credential, and it's just that's the mechanism you'd use.
But even then, it's still a use case by use case scenario versus. It's inherently tied to chain credentials or to consent receipts.
Absolutely, and I think it's good that we flagged it so that we're kind of at least it's on our radar. And then as we flesh things out, then we can kind of, I'm sure we'll come to a common resolution of the best way to do it. We don't have to decide right now.
No, planting the seed. Let's see what grows.
Perfect. That's good, because we're about out of time.
Thank you for the opportunity to present.
I'm very grateful for you presenting and in spawning this conversation and advancing the thinking here. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We are out of time. We will see you on Rocket Chat and elsewhere, and we'll talk to you all next week. Thank you.
Okay. Cheers, guys.
Good night.
Bye.